It's great to finally meet. I heard great things about you.
Well, I don't know if I deserve them. I think at 11:30 p.m. I got a second offer from a competitor to Novo, and actually the terms were not very different. A few years later, Novo is one of the dominant market cap in the world, in a great deal for us.
Was it already your plan to go in, like exit pretty early?
Maybe I'm not smart enough to suit the other way around.
Hi, I'm your host Philip, and welcome to a new episode of the Flood Bio Show, where I interview the best Europeans in biotech to help you grow. Today, I'm back in house, quite sunny and nice, to talk with Marc de Garidel, who is the new CEO of Abivax. Marc is one of these biopharma veterans with an impressive track record. He made $2 billion exits. He was the CEO of a French biopharma Ipsen, and now made the biggest IPO ever for a French biotech on the Nasdaq with Abivax. Actually, I don't know him personally, but I've heard great things about him, both on the track record side, but also on the personal side. So I'm very excited to meet with him. And we will talk about actually what were the challenges behind the exits, as well as why Abivax could be a next big success. So let's head to the office and meet with him. Welcome to the show, Marc.
Thank you very much for having me.
Great. It's great to finally meet. I mean, I heard great things about you.
I don't know if I deserve them, but it's good to be here.
Let's see. Actually, for today, I want to start with the two exits you did prior to Abivax. I mean, both were in the billions. I mean, COVID, I think, was $775 million upfront dollars. Cinco was $1.8 billion that was in cash, which is impressive. Actually, I don't know many people who did two exits like this. But I've also heard that it was not a smooth ride. So could you like elaborate a bit more on what happened and what didn't make it a smooth ride?
Well, as you know, biotech is always a bit of a lively experience. So I think in the case of Corvidia, the challenge was that we're developing an anti-inflammatory treatment for atherosclerosis. And we had been actually in discussion with one of the big pharma fairly early on when I joined. But what they wanted to see was actually the phase two completion before possibly doing a deal. The challenge also of the program was related to the fact that the phase two was relatively simple to execute. It was a 250-patient trial. But the phase three would be more like 3,000 to 5,000 patients with costs probably ranging from $300 to $400 million for the phase three. So it was clear from a Corvidia standpoint that the step from phase two to phase three would be a difficult process. And we were preparing actually for an IPO in that context. So we actually ran a sort of a dual approach. One was indeed execution of the phase two and seeing whether a partnership could be possible, and still in parallel trying to raise money for the phase three in case a partnership would not happen. Yeah. So I think what was very interesting is we got actually a first offer from a big pharma company. Again, maybe
not from Novo, from another
one. From another one who came about. And the first proposal was we thought was very low. So we told them, we cannot accept. We keep going with our phase two. But as the phase two started to get toward the end, then we had a very productive discussion, actually starting at Jefferies, which was in November, preceding basically the deal. And Novo started to show real interest into possibly looking at our phase two data and possibly doing a partnership. So we at JP Morgan organized a more thorough meeting with basically all the research team and R&D team actually of Novo and ourselves to try to come to a potential agreement on conditions for a deal. So Novo followed that procedure and essentially gave us a term sheet in March of that year.
It was quick.
It was quick, yeah. But this was upon the condition of success in a phase two, which, you know, again, could be always argumented and challenged. So we, you know, so we are on one hand very happy, but we had still to wait for the result of the phase two. And then when the phase two results were uncovered, we are obviously very happy with the results, and we communicated that to Novo. But that, in the meantime, so I gave a call to the other party saying, you know, now we have some great results.
Let's say,
are you still interested, or would you consider, you know, doing a partnership with us? Because we, you know, we have already a term sheet from a great partner. And you know, I remember vividly because I was actually, you know, in my house. This was, you know, COVID time, so this was when everything was virtual. I was, you know, in my home in near Boston. And I got this call from the head of R&D from this big pharma, whom I knew actually from history. Mm. He told me, no, Mark, we are very interested in possibly doing a deal with you, but give us a bit of time because we need to analyze your phase two and our confidentiality. But we'll come back by Friday midnight of that week.
Okay.
So, you know.
Which months are we talking about?
We are probably in at the end of we are in June. June of 2020. So then that Friday, at maybe 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I called the head of BD at that company and I said, you know, I haven't heard anything from you. Are you going to submit anything? Or because otherwise, you know, the other party is ready to sign. So you know, they this business officer says, yeah, we are preparing something, but give us a bit of time. We know midnight is the deadline. So I think at 11:30 p.m.
Eastern time or
Eastern time, Eastern time, I got the second offer from a competitor to Novo, and actually the terms were not very different. So I sent an immediate message to the board. I had given them obviously the heads up that things were cooking, but I wasn't sure.
Yeah.
And then I told them we need to probably organize a board meeting tomorrow to review the two bids and see what you want to do. But I think I would propose we take a bank to help us in through the process. So to cut a long story short, we put in place a bidding system. Yeah. So the bank organized. So by the following Tuesday,
yeah,
we would have essentially competing bids, yeah, and the best offer would win. And what was very interesting is a big pharma who thought they would win actually lost to Novo, who actually, you know, overbid and increase, you know, in within 2 or 3 days. The terms changed substantially. So it was wonderful for obviously for
shareholders.
So shareholders was wonderful for us. And I think ultimately, now Novo is developing. I think I believe they are doing 3 phase 3s for the drug, and hopefully in the next couple of years we're going to know whether this drug is going to be a bigger drug for reducing inflammation and arteriosclerosis in patients. Yeah.
I mean, I heard also, I think it was one of the biggest deals of Novo around that, or even like, not ever, but in these years around, they didn't make that many big deals.
That's right. Yeah, it was the first, actually. I think it was.
And they lost Ablings. I think Ablings they lost it to Sanofi.
Yeah, exactly. So for Novo, it was a big step forward. And I remember the discussion with Lars, you know, the CEO of Novo, who's actually a great CEO. And I, you know, he told me, yes, this would be already a big step for them. So obviously, you know, a few years later, Novo is a, you know, one of the dominant market cap in the world with Ablorag. But it's been a great deal for us.
No, it's nice. On this outbidding, it reminds me another story, which I forgot the name of the biotech, but it was, I think, last year where there was like outbidding 2-3 times and it went up to like $1 billion when the first offer was like 5 or 6 times lower.
Yeah.
I mean,
in our case, we said on Tuesday,
yeah,
you need to have your bid by noon. We'll have a board meeting at 1. At 2 o'clock, we'll let you know who has win and who has lost.
That's pretty quick. That's a quick time. But I'm wondering more on the lessons learned and for you. I mean, as running a biotech, I don't really understand why you wouldn't do such a process or try to get, I guess, what's the limiting factors if you have not enough interest from pharma? Or what would be the...
No, I think part of the challenge was, in order to finance phase three, that is going to cost, $300 to $400 to $500 million. You know, there are not so many so many pharmas at the time who would have been interested. And by the way, cardiovascular, you remember,
yes,
was kind of ignored starting in the mid 2010 period because of exactly this studies that are very big, and you need to do an outcome study, so you need to demonstrate that you're really literally saving lives. And a number of pharmas like Roche and Novartis, just to name a few, had spent up to $700 million in studies, and then everything bust because the results were not good. So I think already Corvidia was one of the first, I mean, certainly one of the most surprising deal at the time. One, it was because it was COVID, everything was kind of dead, and two, it was in a therapeutic area where no one would have expected a deal.
Yes, wow, that's amazing. And I guess from what you just said also on the running phase three, there's also a good chance that the milestones would be paid, because I think
we have 75
up front, but then there was what, 1 point?
Well, there is another 1.4 billion in milestone, 700 million related to basically registration of the drug, and then there are milestones on sales.
Yeah.
We'll see.
I mean, fingers crossed. I mean, I would then also, cardiovascular already was, I mean, as you said, from big pharma, dropped it or less interest, but especially as a biotech, very few biotechs going there,
yes,
also from the size of the trial and the money you need to raise. But you are basically coming with Cinqor, but also in the cardiovascular space.
So, yes.
And it worked also pretty well. So.
Yeah, because I think, at the end of the day, almost regardless of the therapeutic areas, what you have to try to find is our drugs which can, bring a therapeutic value to patients. And because a lot of companies were in oncology, everyone tend to flock to the same areas. Actually, in cardiovascular, there was not so many assets, but there were still a few good assets.
Yeah.
And the Cinqor asset was actually a drug that was initially at Roche.
Okay.
Roche decided to get out of cardiovascular, but they had done all the really very good quality experiments in preclinical setting. And what happened is, an incubator basically negotiated with the help of Sofinnova Investments and Sofinnova Partners the extraction of the drug out of Roche to start developing it in human clinical trials. But all the foundation of the work was done, it was first class work from Roche. So for me, when I was contacted again by Sofinnova to be part of this new adventure, I was very reassured that the foundation
was
very solid. The early preclinical work was first class, and also the positioning of the drug was going to be very differentiated from anything that had been in existence to treat those hard to treat resistant hypertension patients.
Yeah, and then you joined, and then what can you go through the what happened? I mean, this was even faster than Corvidia.
It was faster, but it was also a fairly lively experience because a few months into the job, first we got a lawsuit from the incubator who was in Cincinnati because we had transferred some of the employees in the incubator into Cinqor,
yeah,
which by the way was
part of the program. Everybody had agreed to, but there was some question about compensation and things like that, stock options. So we already ran into a lawsuit from with the incubator, was also part of our shareholder basis. So, and in the meantime, I needed to raise, you know, funding, you know, to accelerate and to conduct four phase twos pretty much in parallel. So the good news is we were able to raise, you know, summer of 2021, about 190 million in a Series B.
Yeah, well.
That was the first big basis, and then we wanted to do an IPO by the end of the year or early in 2022. And then, as you know, 21 was the year of where things started to shake up, especially in the second half of 21, where it became unclear as to whether we could do an IPO. And then we had this lawsuit. So we eventually, the good story is that we were able to resolve the lawsuit. And then we were able to be out, do the first IPO of 2022. We are the first one listed on the NASDAQ. And actually, we did actually very well because I think everybody was excited about our program. And again, we raised another 200 million through that process. You know, a few months passed. We have the first results of our study in this hard to treat.
Was the phase two results?
A few months later.
Yeah.
And on that basis, it was really successful. And as a result, we were able to do another follow on. Mm. We raised another, 200 plus. So we basically raised 600 million within a year, which was again, one of the highest in the world in that period. And while we were doing this, AstraZeneca was actually watching us because they thought, again, this mechanism of action. So it's basically inhibiting a very key hormone that plays a role in hypertension. And they were very interested in this mechanism of action, possibly combine it with their SGLT2 for CKD patients.
Okay.
So, that discussion with AstraZeneca took almost a year to complete before they made an offer. But then, life in the biotech, as I said, is never easy. The second phase two study that we were doing in a less severe population actually was a disaster.
Okay.
So everything, basically the results were poor, not because the drug didn't work, but essentially the patients we enrolled and the centers that were used, even though they were the same center in the hard-to-treat population, there was a lack of compliance in the study. So basically, the criteria for inclusion were not very well respected by the centers. And we had a huge placebo effect. So actually, this was, I think, one of the worst studies ever seen with a placebo effect of 16 millimeters for mercury. We've never seen that before in any study. So it was an entire disaster. So
crazy how, okay.
But the good news was because we had taken, blood samples of the patient at baseline and at the end of the study, we were able to demonstrate over time that, again, it was that had nothing to do with the drug. It was really poor execution of the trial by the centers, and that actually nothing went wrong. And by the way, we shared it with the FDA. The FDA at the end of the phase two meeting did recognize the same thing, and AstraZeneca was able to complete the transaction.
It must be really hard also to frame the story or even explain. I mean, usually the phase two results are kind of the headlines or like studies, and then it's like arguing, and every biotech when there's a low result, they try to argue, but at least from my experience, it's never that clear that it's like...
No, sure. I mean, when we announced the result, the stock went down by nearly 50%.
Yeah.
But again, I have a very good scientific team. We are also by great opinion leaders. Because we had such amazing results in this hard-to-treat population, everybody knew it was not making sense. It would not work in a less severe population, right? Because well, if it works for a very young population, it can't.
Yeah.
And it had something to do with you know, the design of the study or the way it was conducted. So anyway, just to say, yeah, we went from, you know, going up, then we crashed, and then we came back. And then, you know, AstraZeneca, you know, bought us, and in the context of competition, because there was another company that was, you know, okay, that would have been interested probably to get bought. But, we, you know, in the end...
And did you do also outbidding process there?
So we had some discussion with a few companies, but I think some of them were a bit, you know... shaken by the early population results, so they decided to pass.
Okay, yeah. But I'm curious about this on the compliance and how's run the clinical trial. What were your lessons there? What would you, let's say, do differently next
time? Yeah, well, I think what you learn is that which by the way applies to Abivax, I said to the team here, is the discipline of conducting a trial is extremely important. You have to. There is a balance between quality and speed, right? And the danger that we all have in this industry is because of money reasons and you know, the time it takes to develop drugs is to go very fast.
Yes.
And when you want to go very fast, you go to centers. They are not cheating on purpose, you know, that's not what we're saying. But their standards may not be as high as you want. Or what the doctors do is that they don't, you know, pay the same level of attention when they, you know, recruit the patients in terms of the criteria. And, you know, so the lesson for us, certainly for Abivax, is we have to work on the placebo effect in these studies,
yeah.
And part of it is having MSRs to help train the centers so that they target the right type of patients, and to do, you know, sometimes audits of these centers extensively, so that again those centers are not enrolled if they don't if their discipline is not as high as we would like to be.
And you do that, or even the audits internally, or then it's also, I mean, I guess you're working with the CRO.
Yeah, so it usually is the CRO who does that for you.
Yeah.
Or you can independently, depending upon, you know, some companies do it independently, but yeah, the CRO can do that.
I guess also you are very also careful in choosing your CRO, even like supervising and work.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
And probably to me, the second lesson which we have applied actually at Abivax is we had a limited number of oversight at Syncor.
Mm.
So we are fairly, you know, relying on the CRO, was a good quality CRO, but nevertheless, we probably, you know,
trip out too much.
Yeah, yeah.
And I guess with any kind of service providers, I mean, the way you manage the service provider makes also a huge difference.
Yeah, but yes, I mean, but that I think we had, I mean, the relationship with steering committee, we reused a number of things. But I think still the key to me is you need, when you are a small biotech company, you know, again, when you have been used to an outsourced model, you still need to make sure you have core competencies,
yeah,
and some people you hire who have skin in the game, who are on your side, you know, to review what the CRO is doing and the centers.
Makes sense. That's good. So taking a step back to what you mentioned on doing IPO on Syncor at the period where you were one of the first first or the only one of the year, and now you did again with switching to Abivax, especially one of the only one this year, at least in this size, and I think was the biggest one of a French biotech ever on the Nasdaq. Even I compiled data, I think in the last 5 years at least, must be the top five in Europe even, which is really impressive as well. How did you manage this when it's, you, like, how did you manage it when the in both cases, the market was just not favorable, and you still managed to push through it. I mean,
well, obviously, there are a number of factors that played. I think part of the success was already ingrained in the fact that in February of this year, the company had done a crossover round, attracting some top-notch crossover funds. So I think there was a foundation of investors, deep pocket investors, US investors, who knew well, you know, the story, and we are going to help back the IPO story. Yeah. But I think part of the reason we were successful is that, you know, we brought also a team on top of the existing team. We did a great job for phase two. We brought much more US experience in the management team quickly. You know, we did a strategic review within 2 months. We laid out a plan, which is not, you know, a 6 month plan, but really the 7 year plan in terms of how we could exploit the potential of bifasimod, which is, you know, a very, very attractive drug potentially because it's an oral treatment. It's an immunomodulator, so it's not like blocking one pathway for specific reasons. So it helps probably reduce the risk of safety, adverse events, issues, which we have seen, by the way, in phase two, where so far the profile has been very good. So that strategy with a great drug, a great potential drug like this, was, I think, you know, became a bit clearer to the financial community. And then we were helped also by the fact that we released 2 year data on the drug. That was, I think, you know, again, it's not head-to-head study, but this is the best ever seen in ulcerative colitis. So I think the conjunction of, you know, having already some key investors up front, to have a management team that I think, you know, had the credibility in terms of the strategy, but also execution with some of the arena people who came in, plus the phase two data, 2 year data, which was really best, kind of best in class combination. You know, the key elements were there for a successful IPO. Then, you know, the market obviously was not good, and actually got worse and worse because obviously not only inflation, not only the Ukraine war, and then, you know, what happened in Gaza and Israel. So we're, you know, certainly lucky to go through this IPO, but the conditions here were not the best, and the price, you know, was not initially, we had a negative reaction after the listing, but now we're essentially back to the price of the IPO. So again, you go through this tribulation, but fundamentally what was important is to get the money to execute the phase three program in ulcerative colitis, to do the phase two in Crohn's disease, and potentially develop a follow-on product for the long term.
I want to go back to the pivot with Sophie Nova coming in and you coming in, because in the IPO, I think you raised a bit over 200 million, but before you raised, what was it, from Sophie Nova invested, I think it was 150, and then debt on top, so in total was 500 million, if I'm correct on the numbers.
Yeah, so what we raised this year is 130 million euros in February. We did debt facility in August for 150, and then we raised about 200 million euros net in the IPO. So we raised altogether about 500 million, which, by the way, is in the top five, you know, in the world of biotech this year.
Yes,
and certainly, you know, the largest amount. Not in France, but in Europe. Within a year.
Can you go back to the story? I think I heard that Sophie Nova played really a pivotal role.
Yes.
In kind of the, I don't know if you call it a relaunch, a reboot.
That's a pivot.
Can you go a bit like specifically of what happened, how they contacted you, or
sure,
everything fitted there?
Sure. So again, if you go back a year ago, company again was planning to be sold after the phase two. Unfortunately, it didn't get sold. And as a result, it had still announced that it was moving to phase three with a large potential commitment of probably 200 to 300 million euros. Yeah. So the company got into a severe situation where, it had a good drug, but it was not well financed. So Sofinnova partners played a key role.
They were a bit stuck, I guess. They couldn't start the phase three at the same time.
Exactly.
Hard to
exactly. So they delayed a bit the phase three as a result because they thought, this is a good trial, so someone will show up. And, in the end, nobody showed up. So part of the key roles that Sofinnova partners played already a year ago was they said, okay, we need to reshape the way we operate. We need to change the chairman, to have a chairman who has probably more experience in a phase three development program. And also, because of the sheer scale-up, the complexities, we need to change the CEO to address the complexity of a large program. And someone who can also help raise a large amount of money. So that's where Sofinnova came in essentially September, October of last year.
And they were already shareholder before.
Well, yeah. So my story was a bit of funny because when I got out of Syncore, I announced the deal at JPM, and I said I'm dead, I'm finished, I want to retire, so I want to go back to Europe because I was based in Boston before. I want to retire, but Sofinnova partners came back and said, oh, Mark, can we do a bit of an exception?
One more.
Said, no, not one more. I said, okay, could you be a chairman of one of our companies?
Okay.
So I said, well, being a chairman is obviously a different story. So that maybe we have obviously a great history together. Why not? So I asked, Antoine, can you tell me, what are your two top picks in your portfolio? Because I don't want to do the work, please tell me what are the best companies in your portfolio where you are looking for a chance. So Abivax was one of the two, and as I got into then the discussion with Kinam, who was on the board of Abivax, I was more and more attracted by the science, by what had been done, by this sort of turnaround that needed to be done. And my conclusion, which I expressed to Kinam, was at the end, I think, you'd be better off having me as CEO than a chairman because, there is very little time for this company for a turnaround, given the fact that, the fact it's not well financed. Phase three has started, but it's not really going fast enough. So you need someone to execute, to execute, and I'm willing to do that.
Okay.
So I changed my mind,
you sold yourself to do it again.
Exactly, but I have no regret. So it's it's a great undertaking. We can possibly change, the fate of patients in the long term in this iterative collective setting. This is very, very unique. Now there are always risks when you do clinical development, and it's a wonderful opportunity.
That's an amazing story, and I'm quite impressed by how quickly you executed. Also, since joining, raising these kind of rounds of even changing or hiring more US based C levels. Seems like you went very fast.
Yes.
How did you manage to go that fast?
I think it's when you have experience, the tempo. I think if you look back at Syncore was already managed in a very overall efficient way. So it's once you've done the analysis of what is the challenge of the company, the biotech, then it's more are you convinced the board on one end to get the resources you need? And two, to put the process in place so that you get the money you need to execute, which was the IPO, and then put in place a team that will be ultimately responsible. And I think where also I got some help is that Sofinnova and the board attracted in the spring, so in March, Sheldon Sloan, who was you know, the person who ran the ARENA studies, the UC study at so at ARENA, which ultimately got bought by Pfizer. So Sheldon had a great understanding of how to run you know, a large phase three iterative creative program. So, and we both.
That's both independently. Or
well, independently, yeah, he came before me, even though I was part of the process indirectly of because I was you know being considered to, as a chairman, so they asked me to speak with him, even though he didn't know that I was going to be ultimately the CEO. He thought I was going to be the chairman, but yeah, so it was part of this process. But the fact that we had people we knew, and then we attracted you know a bunch of people very quickly, so we didn't need to go through you know headhunters. And you know all the gyration of normal recruiting because we knew people in the field who could you know be able to execute such a complex trial.
That's good. I mean, I guess what also it helps to, as you said, to have gone through it. And I mean, I guess massive network as well.
Yes, exactly. From this. It helps from.
That's great. The for the clinical results, I'm curious on. If we can go a bit more into the science and slash the clinics, how, because I mean in UC or even in IBD, I mean there's still at least in IBD there's quite a lot of drugs also like around. I mean, can you go a bit on how good were the phase two, how it compares to the standard of care, or the,
sure,
what's in development? I can
sure. So I think again, first, you know, to help a bit understand the setting. So when you have ulcerative colitis, you know, the symptoms you have as a patient, you have rectal bleeding. You go very frequently. You know, you need to go to the bathroom very often, including at night. And then gastroenterologists who treat you ask you to do you know a sort of a colonoscopy to check. Whether your you know the lining of your the stroma of your intestine is being altered by you know many ulcers or not, so from that sort of conjunction of looking at those three elements, there is a score that is being you know sort of used by the gastroenterologist to assess the severity of your disease. So and this is a population again for mostly. People are diagnosed between 20 and 40 years old. So it's a very, it affects a young population. So what happens is for the treatment, usually what happens, you get a 5 ASA. So that's sort of an old, you know, generic compound that start to stabilize your disease for a little while. But very often after a few months or maybe a year or two, you know, disease continues to progress. And then the doctors start to put you on corticosteroids. Corticosteroids, they are, again, good to against the flare-up, so when you have a peak of inflammation. However, if you prescribe corticosteroids in the long term, it can affect, you know,
the massive systemic side effects.
Yeah, systemic, like diabetes and, you know, increases the risk of death and so on. So doctors really want an alternative. So before we talk about obefazimod, until now, what happened was mostly you had what they called, you know, advanced treatments or biotherapies, which were, you know, the anti-TNF. The anti-IL-23, I mean, the Rinvoq, so the JAK1s. All those drugs have their utilities. But they face a few challenges. One is some of them have black box safety warnings because they have some serious, you know, adverse events in terms of either affecting the human system and therefore being more prone to infections or cardiac problems. Some of them have more recently who have arrived, like the S1P, the ozanimod from BMS, which is the first real potential oral treatment before Rinvoq as pre-initiation requirements. So you need to ocular exam because you have a risk of loss of vision up to 30%. So essentially you have lot of drugs out there. Some are highly effective for a while, but then over time, either their efficacy starts to wane, or two, the side effects, the adverse events start to show up and they are really problematic, which forces doctors to change treatment for patients. So, obefazimod, given the phase 2 results we have seen, is ideally placed now as what we call a first line or advanced therapy agent. Why? Because we think we could be well placed after, again, 5-ASAs and corticosteroids, but before all these advanced therapies would generate their own set of challenges. And the profile of obefazimod is such that when you look at the phase 2 result, is that first, after 8 weeks, it has a competitive response for patients. Yeah. It's really in the landscape of all the other drugs. But then over time, after 1 year, 2 years, you see this lasting efficacy that we don't see with many of the other.
The 3 years data.
Yeah, 3 years data, yeah. You know, you have, you know, if you take the patients who were enrolled at the beginning of the study, 2 years later, regardless of the profile of those patients, you know, 50% of them are still controlled. If you take now the patients who responded after 8 weeks, so 2/3 of these patients are controlled after 2 years. I mean, no one, you know, again, it's not we cannot claim a superiority because we don't have head-to-head. But in absolute terms of any published studies, we have the best response. And this is what was presented at the recent Congress at UEGW, which is basically the gastro week for Europe, in Copenhagen, where we were, you know, in the session New Kids on the Block, so basically new product. Mm. And our data was judged as, you know, the best abstract, because simply, you know, it is the best data out there, yeah. So that's why I think obefazimod has a very important role to play. And to finish just on the safety front,
yeah.
You know, because doctors are, you know, this is a chronic condition, doctors are obviously very worried about the safety of their patient.
Yeah.
So what we have seen is we have treated more than 1,000 patients now, and we haven't seen any opportunistic infections. We have not seen cancer, which could be certainly a risk when you depress the immune system. Nothing of this nature so far. And that's more than 1,000 patients. So, again, we
thought that could be. Yeah.
So we think again, this drug could be very important for the doctors.
I'm curious about UC and IBD. I mean, it's very tied to the microbiome.
Yes,
it's down. So, how does it connect, let's say, to microbiome or even to microbiome drugs or even lifestyle biotherapeutics? I mean, more from an alternative or way to treat it, like.
Yeah, so it's a new mechanism of action. So what it does, it upregulates, so obefazimod in itself upregulates a key molecule, which is called MIR-124.
It's a microRNA.
Yeah, 124. And it's very specific to immune cells. So what microRNA 124 does is essentially, and you know, we've proven that in our preclinical experiments, is if you take a mice that whose immunity is okay, so with no IBD, you'll see you administer obefazimod, you see no impact on the cells of those mice. When you take a mice who has the ulcerative colitis, so it's called the DSS model, what you see when you administer obefazimod, you see the production of a microRNA, accelerating, and basically regulating, you know, different pathways, so that essentially the inflammation that is caused by ulcerative colitis, this is tempered by microRNA. So microRNA 124 is essentially a regulator of the inflammation process. And what's wonderful, it doesn't block, you know, everything.
Yeah.
It's just controls it. And it's, you know, pleiotropic in the sense that it's a physiological you know, reduction of inflammation throughout, for example, you know, the IL-17 pathway, the IL-23, you know, and the macrophages, for example. So it's a more subtle, I would say, way to reduce inflammation than boom, you know, you just attack one pathway, which is great in the short term, but because of the you know, the body, you're redundant, you know, then ultimately the body finds a way to do the inflammation through another pathway.
And I guess that explains, I mean, this more subtle way, and
yes,
explains also why it lasts longer and the safety profile.
Exactly. Exactly.
But still on this, on the cause, because at the end, the cause is still more microbiome.
Yeah,
we are not fixing the cause. You're fixing the symptoms and make it.
We are controlling the disease. We are not addressing, you know, fundamentally the origin.
And which, by the way, the origin makes sense to address. I mean, not for you specifically, but let's say in the current development to actually address it directly.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of companies who have tried. It's extremely difficult because you know, the understanding of IBD, especially let's say if we take psoriasis crisis, it's based upon probably a conjunction of things. One, it could be genetics, so it could be some mutation possibly. Two, could be hormonal too, if a disorder in hormones could also accelerate. And three, it's also the lifestyle. But when you eat, you know, things that are preconditioned with a lot of, you know, sort of bad things, you know, that ultimately accelerates the inflammation of your body and your intestine, and then create this. I mean, so the you know, the science behind IBD sources is still underway. Yeah. There's a lot of work to be done in order to really fully address what you are.
Because I think, at least from my understanding, a lot of microbiome companies are going in IBD, but have not really managed.
Well, microbiome is extremely complex, right? Yeah. Because you have you know, billions of bugs that are have their utilities. Which one are the ones that you want to you know, are fighting and so on. Yeah, this is,
and it's a very recent.
It's a very recent field, and unfortunately, until now, it has not been really highly successful.
I like this. Okay, I like the complementary of there's some microbiome therapeutics that can fix the cause, but it's like, it's a longer term horizon.
Yes.
But at the same time, we need also even small molecules in first line that can be taken easily.
Or long time, or
that's like, because that's one thing I was also wondering. Even if we zoom out a bit, Corvidia, Syncor, and Abivax are all small molecules.
Yeah, no, Corvidia was injectable.
I was wondering what's your feeling there if you just look from a, let's say, small molecules versus biologicals versus, or like more complex cell gene therapy. How do you see it? Like, what's your?
I mean, different modalities have their own values. So it depends upon the disease, what you want to do. So I don't think one should say it's one versus the other. I think it depends on the circumstances of the disease and what you're trying to address. But one thing we forgot to mention is, for example, for the future of IBD is a combination therapy. So a bit like in oncology, where you know when you basically combine different mechanisms of action. To find a better solution for patients. So we believe, based also on the feedback of our key opinion leaders around the world, they told us obefazimod, with this you know, sort of unique mechanism of action, could lend itself with other products that are out there, and they can complement each other maybe by, you know, doing some of this highly effective drug. Maybe their dose could be reduced. You could add obefazimod on top, or you could start with one of these drugs and then put in maintenance. So there could be, you know, a variety of combination that could be very helpful to patients. So this is one thing that we are going to start actually preclinical experiments right now, and hopefully we'll have results of those combinations in the course of 2024, by the end of 2024, so that in 2025. Once we have the induction data, hopefully, you know, very positive data, we can start doing combo work as well.
Okay. Now that's, I mean, I like your approach of not necessarily opposing small molecules versus modality, because I feel also, I mean, quite a lot of biotechs, I guess maybe because they come from the science, they're very focused on their platform, on their like modality, and will compare it to the rest. When I think at the end of the day, what tends to matter more is, okay, what are your
data? Yeah. And what are you solving for? Yeah, sure. Yeah. I think the challenge, for example, with cell therapy and gene therapy is cell therapy is more the production. This process and manufacturing is extremely difficult to do. And the time it takes to do that for those patients in the context of some of the acute disease. And then gene therapy, I think the next challenge is, as you know, has been, you know, what is, you know, everybody thought, you know, you do one injection, you're done, you're fixed for the rest of your life. Well, it turns out that it's not that simple. Unfortunately, it seems also to have a waning effect over time. That's one. And two, you have the safety side of which what is the support of, virus or what is the platform of your gene therapy
platform.
Yeah. So that, when it is administered to patients, you don't also create some adverse events that are not welcome. So, yeah, I mean, again, science is always in evolution, so you need to learn and need to be open about different avenues.
Yeah, that's good. On the question about on the market of where is the market, very connected to Abivax, but also more a bit more of a general question. I think if I remember that in one of the press mentioned that 70% of the market for Abivax is in the US.
Yes.
And I feel is it because there's more patients there from it's more just from a market opportunity from a reimbursement policy?
Yeah. So in the US, for example, if I give you some numbers, in the US there are about 800,000 patients who have ulcerative colitis.
Yes.
When we look at the population we can address, we think we can address about 25% of those.
Yeah.
Because they wouldn't be, they would be either, already once they have finished their first conventional therapy treatment, or we could get switched from current, advanced therapy treatment where they fail or they have too much side effects. So that's about 200,000. In the US, just to give you an idea, the price of treatment, the net price after rebate to the PBMs is about $50,000 per year per patient. So so if you multiply what we think, is a potential, the addressable population for us out of the 800,000, we think we could have about 25%. So 200,000 patients times per year, 50 times 50,000, that's a $10 billion market opportunity.
Yeah.
So that's why we think, again, provided we can show again in phase three what we've seen in phase two, this is a $10 billion market opportunity. So we are not going to get obviously all the market, but 10%, it's already been, and this is only ulcerative colitis. The market in Europe in terms of patient is actually slightly higher, but as you know, the challenge in Europe, our prices have been going down and down and down. And governments are all reluctant to pay, honestly, for big innovation. So, the US is 70% of the market. So,
if it's 10 billion, so what is it in Europe would be 2-3 billion potential market?
Yeah, the Europe is about 20%
of the US. Yeah. And what do you think about this from if you reflect? I mean, you mentioned already that it's hard in Europe for biotechs to get innovation finance. How do you reflect on this? I mean, I think for me, what I see is, I mean, that's kind of a fact, but I think it's makes it very challenging for European biotechs to actually, let's say, access the market, or forces them to go after the US market, which is not necessarily that easy from a talent, location, access to capital.
Yes.
So what's your, but do you think about the situation?
Well, I think so if you are a biotech in Europe and you have a good drug, you can start indeed the experiments in Europe, but quickly, you need to take a look at the US market.
Yeah.
And because this is where, you know, in general, most of the opportunity is going to be. And also, this is where most of the sophisticated investors and deep pocket investors are. So it means that for you know, the management of biotech, the need to have CEOs and management team with Europe slash US experience is becoming more and more important. Otherwise, what would happen is, if you can do that, and what you have to do as a biotech in Europe, you have to partner quickly with you know, a big pharma company that is going to do the job for you in the US and will do it obviously very well. But, you know, obviously the value creation is very different if you do a partnership very early as a small biotech versus later when you get the benefits of having, you know, produced, you know, good results and having partly address again the challenge of the US market.
I'm thinking maybe also from a policy point of view. I mean, talking Europe or even in France about financing innovation a lot, and more on the financing side a lot in the early stage side, but there's a market is not there.
It's, yeah, no, the irony, the
hindrance.
I mean, I was recently the minister doing a speech here, you know, the Ministry of Finance here in France, I think 3 weeks ago, but. You know, part of the irony is that Europe helps, you know, the foundation of the small biotechs, the early stage. I think there is really good process, good help, and there are, you know, good investors. The challenge is, as soon as you go into more intense, you know, clinical trials, funding requirements, and so on. Then, unfortunately, because there is less money available in Europe, you need to go to the US. And then, because of the cost of doing those trials, the return that are expected by investors are such that today, and mostly, it is, you know, it is in the US, it's the US system that rewards innovation. So, you know, many of the CEOs of large pharma companies, including, you know, European, like, you know, Pascal Soriot or Varas at Novartis, have said, you know, the European system needs really to rethink itself in order to adopt, you know, innovation in the long term. Because the risk, if we don't do that, you know, you're going to have the haves and the have-nots.
Yeah, and I mean, if the market rewards less innovation as well, means, in a way, less returns means less investors.
Exactly.
Yeah. I guess it's a society choice. I mean,
yeah, these are, again, they are complicated. They are complicated issues. But you know, our role, at least as a leader in the industry, is just to give the heads up that, you know, there are consequences to what you know, public you know, politicians do, and we, again, you know, our We are here also to try to help find solutions, but there is, you know, they need to reward the people who take risks, right? Because it's a very hard industry. It's very hard to develop drugs. You know, a lot of them fail, and you know, so there's a few that are making it to the finish line. You know, should be rewarded.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's a very complex
yes
decision, even on the political level. But I feel like it's not really, let's say, improving. At least I've seen in France or even in Germany that a lot of even innovative drugs are even withdrawn from certain markets in Europe, even though they're already approved for more for pricing and market access, and while they're already in the US. Yeah. But let's see how let's see how it evolves. Maybe more on the on your more on the personal your story. Like, so I'm curious if on both Corvidia, Syncor, even Abivax, was it already your plan to go in and, let's say, not flip, let's say, but like exit pretty early, or was it more like opportunity-based, depending on what happened?
No, you know, I think the fundamental of what we do is develop good drugs. So I am actually absolutely, you know, I'm trying to preach that the best way actually to sell a company,
like a great product,
is to make a great product and to have and to believe it is a great product. You don't control, you know, a CEO. You don't control what the big pharma is going to do. People who think it's easy to do a deal, you know, this is one of the hardest things to do. So the only thing you have, you know, control. With your tool, you control, is to develop a good drug and think long term. Think about, you know, what this drug could be in 3 in 6 years. And then you need to rally everyone, including the investors, to support the program so that the drug needs to be well differentiated. Where I you know, part of my criteria when I have looked at drugs is differentiation. You can't bring, you know, drugs that are me-toos. You know, the system cannot. But I still am convinced that bringing something that makes a difference to patients and that doctors would like to prescribe, that's why we are in this business. So fundamentally, you know, I'm sort of a bit like a Warren Buffett type of person in the sense that you need to create things, you know, that are tangible, that are going to help patients. And then whether you do a deal or not, this is to some extent secondary because it's a mean to
the consequence.
It's a consequence. Yeah. And I refute, and I think, you know, my judgment, the best CEOs are this way. People who want to make money quickly on technology, okay, if you're lucky, yes, you can make it and make maybe a huge amount of money. But this is really more the exception than the rule, and probably it is not good because what you do when you're too short-term oriented, you know, you try to hide things or you don't develop the drug as well.
Yeah.
And ultimately, that's not good for patients. So again, I think fundamentally, what we are here for, develop good drugs. Companies, I know, are bought and are not sold. No one can tell. So I didn't come to say, okay, I'm going to sell, you know, in 1 year. I had no idea. The only thing I know, you need to develop well drug. You need to do it with tempo and quality. And this is, you know, the sort of the combination of the two, which is the hardest thing to do. And you could see Zincor, on one end, we did wonderful. We still, you know, blew up one study, but at the end of the day, we had a great outcome for the final goal.
Wow. I like that. I like it a lot, actually. It's a great transition to when I talked to Bomi from Sofino. She said the first time she met you, you gave her, she said, he gave me faith in humanity. So I thought it was very, like, very nice compliment. I was waiting to meet you, but from what we discussed, I think I can see where it's coming. I like this, like, I mean, sound very caring and focusing really on the patient and the problem to solve.
Yes.
And then the rest.
Yes, with
Marlo. And
exactly. And then probably because maybe I'm not smart enough to the other way around. No, but I think fundamentally that's why we are for. And that's, you know, when you are, you know, building a company, you know, you're attracting people want to have a mission. Yes, money is obviously important. Everyone wants to make money for sure. But at the end of the day, you know, if you don't do anything meaningful when you come every day to the office, you know, what is your, you know, what's your role? What's, you know? So I think this is where, you know, it's a kind of a passion and you need to like that. And some people do, some don't, but.
I mean, a lot of people in the industry do,
yeah.
Especially in, I would say, in the biotech industry, maybe more than in some big pharma where it tends to be maybe a bit more diluted, at least from my experience, but not all big pharma are like this. There are a lot of people who care also in this pharma.
Yeah.
But I'm curious on your side, maybe if you can zoom out even, let's say, where did it like originate? Is it like something that you had from very young, or you cultivated, or some experience you were confronted to that?
I think it's probably hard to say. I think it's partly you see when you are, you know, I was raised on a farm and I was raised, you know, in a sort of in an environment where things were, you know, sort of difficult. So I think what you learn is, yeah, life is not simple, and everything you do, you know, it takes time to do things. But I think the probably the generosity comes more from, I think, from my mother, who was a very kind person and tried to help actually poor people. So maybe I have a bit of a few genes from that.
Yeah.
But I think, honestly, it's a bit of the luck of, you know, if you ask me whether I would be in this position 40 years ago, I would have said never, even 20 years ago. So, you know, life takes turns. You know, I think the importance also of meeting key people, people who are, you know, who help you grow in your career. You know, that's also what I say when you're looking for a new job. Think about, you know, the manager. To me, the company is one thing. The other is the job, is the manager you have. Yeah. Because the manager can help you grow, or can destroy you, or can make you indifferent. But
yeah.
So you develop this kind of skills because you get inspired. You see some people who are very you know, they're charismatic or doing things. And by the way, you know, this principle of do the right thing and then money will come. This was, you know, the first time I heard that was one of was the CEO of American Express. He was in Paris. He attended his conference, and Amex became, you know, one of the most successful company at the time. You know, again, 40 years ago. And he said, you know, always, you know, don't think about money. Think as an executive. Think about building something tangible.
Just funny for a financial company, right?
Yeah. But he did a remarkable.
It's even more important.
Look at some people who have done remarkably well. Like, again, look at Warren Buffett. I think, like, you know, you need to have a mission. You need to have something in which you believe. And then, you know, the luck of life is that sometimes you meet some people who are going to encourage you and give you this thing. So.
And I mean, I like that as well. That's a precondition from your family, from your origins, and then also connecting to the right people. But I guess this precondition also led you to admire or to work with the people and going through. I mean, you went through, let's say, bigger pharma, it's like at Amgen and then Ipsen, and you still have this like deep care and mission, which is, and it's amazing. Maybe as a last question, still on the personal. Actually, I know your son. I didn't mention it when he was running his co-founding a biotech in Boston, and he's also a co-founder. So we talked once, but I'm curious on with such a, like, intense career and high level position in between two continents. How did you like balance, let's say, more personal life as well, and how do you approach it?
Again, I think it's also part of luck. He's lucky to meet a wonderful wife who's been very understanding with the pace of my career. But also, what I think, you can only be successful in your professional career, I think, if you have also some balance, you know, outside. So some people, you know, take that in different ways and do sports, they do, you know, another thing. But I think at least in the long term, I think, you know, personally, having a family, a strong foundation of having kids, always again brings you back to reality. Because when you come home, who cares, you know, whether you're a CEO or not, you still have to do certain things, still have to cook sometimes, you still have to do. And that gives you again this balance that I think is essential. So, you know, yes, I've been again lucky at home. I had a good person with me and who was very understanding and who helped me also. You know, tells me also sometimes where what I do wrong and what I should do more. You need the balance. You need to do things. You know, to relax as well.
Yeah.
The intensity of that's a big danger, especially again when you're on CEO job, is importance versus urgency. You always get, you know, the burning fires every day when you come in the office. There is always when something pops up. But as CEO, you're paid not only to resolve the urgencies, but really fundamentally to shake, you know, the future and to alter the course of the company you're running. And this can only be done if at times you step back, you get out of this crazy world and you think, you know, what do I need to make with, you know, with the team, you know, to can to change the course and to make really a difference in what you do as a company. So it requires a bit of discipline, but it's important, you know, like on the weekend to relax, yeah. Try to avoid to watch, you know, all the time, you know, your iPhone. Because the pressure is constant, but stepping back.
I like that. I share it as well. For running a company, I can second this as well. Yeah. It was great. It was great talking to you. I think it was actually the first time you're on the English podcast, or at least in the recent years, at least talking with Abhi Vaksvich. And I think it's great as well for the audience. I've seen you were on French TV or French. Yeah. But I think for all the audience, at least in Europe and the US who don't speak French, I think it's great. So thanks a lot for joining again.
Thanks, man. Yeah,
and good luck for everything.
Thank you. All right.
Thanks for listening to the end. I really enjoyed the conversation with Mark. It was super inspiring, especially how his mindset behind all these like exits, IPOs, how he focused on the core product on the long term and how everything else follows. If you enjoyed the conversation, please hit the like, follow button, or even leave a review if you're on Spotify or Apple Podcast. Any of these actions would help us a lot. And I would be also curious to hear what you think. So please leave it in the comments below of this post or send me an email to philip@flot.bio. All right, that's it for now. Catch you in the next episode.